so we'll get started. It's 3 o'clock on the dot. So thank you for coming to this panel in the final CWA session of the week. This panel is 5303 Growth and Greed International Development. We have a varied panel with, I know, a diverse set of perspectives. So I think this will be a quite interesting discussion. Let me just give the briefest of introductions for our panel. First, we have Maggie Duncan Simbeye, who's the executive director of a Tanzania NGO, which works to empower Tanzanian women and girls. We also have Ed Elmendorf, who worked for the World Bank for a number of years and has had a varied and interesting career in international development and foreign affairs. And we have Christina Tobias Nahi, who is the director or head of public affairs at Islamic Relief USA. So we'll start off with a few minutes, 5 to 10 minutes by each panelist, and then go to the Q&A. So Maggie, would you like to start?
Yes. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. It sounds amazing when we speak together, not just shake the heads. Thank you. I've been asking myself this question from so long. I've never got one answer. What does it mean when we say development? I have come from East Africa, and the name of the country is Tanzania. And we have had a lot of issues from different people around the world who comes to our country to develop it, And one of the examples is we have diversity. We have enough and amazing, beautiful topography in our country, and that is why tourists, guests, clients will come to visit. Lots of different indigenous groups, more than 120 tribes, nice people, different animals, like I've mentioned, diversity. I remember one day we got people who came and they were teaching people who are living up on the highland on the way to Ngorongoro Conservation Area. And they were teaching them on how to use different fertilizers from other countries, chemicals. And those people, because they need to get crops, they need to get corns, beans, etc. And they believe in educational people. I don't know what does it mean when we say education anyway. Has also a big picture. So those people took those manure and they put it on their field. But if you look down from that area, if you look down, there are this amazing national park, Manyara National Park. And there's a lot of flamingos, elephants, zebras, birds, flowers, different trees. It is very beautiful. And I'm telling you, there's also lakes down there. So what happens when it's raining? Imagine these farms are on the Rift Valley, so it is very up there. So when it's raining, where does that chemical flow? Down to the park. And what happens? One day in April, I stayed in the park for more trainings. I'm a driver guide, one of the only 5 women driver guides in the country. I drive clients in there and things like that. So during low season, we tend to go for more trainings to see more and what is changing and just update our brains. I founded thousands and thousands of flamingo. They're dying. Fish. They're dying. And those people, they came back to these different countries around the world and they said, we have developed African countries to the farming, to do better farming, to do the best farming. So they're killing us, but they think they're helping us. They don't talk to people in the community to know what is surrounding them. They don't like to learn about geography of our country. They just like to plant the ideas, what they have from where they come from, and plant it to our countries, which causes a big impact, negative impact, not only in Africa, but all over the world. And then at the end of the day, people give a lot of money and they talk about global warming and all these kind of things. That is one example. Another example, we have indigenous people, like I've mentioned. They're amazing. Some of them are still practicing their culture, like hunter and gatherers. Those people are still living in a very natural way of life. They're relying on nature. They're relying on wild animals as their food, trees, tubers. They're very friendly with the environment, and they're enjoying, and they're happy. But people will come and like say, oh, we should move Hadza from their land. They should go to the villages and develop. What does it mean when we say development? Is it to have a lot of big houses? Is it to have a lot of nice roads? Is it that only way to develop, or there are different ways of developing? Just for starting, I think I should ending up there, but I will share more with my other colleagues here. Thank you for listening.
It's a privilege and pleasure to be back at CWA again and to talk with you a little about a subject which has been my passion for virtually all of my adult life. Let me start with a quotation from Gandhi. There is enough in the world for everybody's need, but not enough for anybody's greed. A good way to start the panel on this topic. I struggled with the same question that Maggie puts about what is development. And ultimately, I formulated my own answer. I don't recall whether there's any answer in the standard handouts from the World Bank, and maybe Gabriel can give us one if there is one. But the answer I give to that question is development is a broadening of the choices faced by people and a growth in their capacity to make use of their choices. That's pretty abstract, but it goes well beyond things like growth in income and education. It encompasses the institutions that people are confronted with, the environments in which they work. My proposition for you is that international development has been a success story, but the changes are needed in both concept and policy. The dialogue on international development started after World War II with the Marshall Plan, a great success in Europe, leading to the establishment of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, which you probably have heard of, and a focus on development around the world, getting beyond just the European countries of the Marshall Plan. And the OECD became a vehicle which the U.S. used to encourage other countries to engage in international development activities. Just about growth, here we have seen enormous successes, particularly in China and India, lifting literally billions of people out of poverty. This has also been associated with globalization, a term which has a decidedly ambiguous connotation now. 10 years ago, it might have been unambiguously positive for many. But there, too, is an important dimension of greed, if you will, the other side of globalization. We find greedy firms. We find greedy consultants, the so-called Beltway bandits that are widely seen around Washington. We find military suppliers. And we find some multinational firms, many of which are attacked. At the same time, these institutions are important actors in development, and they cannot simply be dismissed. What I'd like to suggest is that it's time to rethink international development. The very term international development tends to suggest a we on one side and a they on another side, and leads too easily into the kinds of experiences that were described by Maggie. In more recent years, terminology has begun to change. We move to phrases like international cooperation for development, and to my mind, even better, development partnerships. The point is to get beyond a notion where outsiders are, quote, doing, unquote, development to local people and institutions and are working with them in partnerships. As we see the concepts and terminology and experience around development changing, we see also a new emphasis on inequality. Inequality was not a concern of people engaged in development 30 years ago. We focus, even in the World Economic Forum, not one known particularly for a concern with the poor, on inequality. Widening income disparities are becoming increasing development issues. So we need to focus less and less on poverty-stricken countries, poor countries, and more on poverty within countries. Looking at development as a question of addressing poverty within countries also legitimizes looking at development not in a North-South framework, but as a universal issue, as an issue affecting all countries. This leads us to the UN's Agenda 2030 of 17 Goals for Sustainable Development, which apply to all countries. The goals are about ending poverty. They are about leaving nobody behind. This is an important change as we think about development. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to take it from where Ed just left off and the UN Sustainable Development Goals. These goals are big and they're ambitious. And it's going to take, as he mentioned, a lot of actors in order to strive to make some progress towards alleviating poverty and the other goals. And some of the actors, I think, are well represented here at this panel. We have Maggie, who's from a local NGO, Ed, formerly from a multilateral, and then myself, I'm representing an international NGO. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the role of international NGOs and what we do specifically, and then I'm going to bring this around to a question that was on the app or a description. For those of you who may have come thinking we were going to talk about some opportunities for volunteerism as well, and kind of talk about why there are challenges to that and what some of the risks are. So I work for a large international NGO called Islamic Relief USA, and we were founded about 40 years ago in the UK, similar to Oxfam, if you're familiar, kind of looking at ways to alleviate what was then the famine in Africa. And as our name denotes, Islamic Relief, generally we are on the ground as first responders when there are emergencies and disasters, primarily if they're natural disasters and unpredictable. More and more, some of the slow onset disasters, again, things like famines, we have them again coming in East Africa, and a lot of different issues with climate change. However, when you land in a place or you fly in with lots of other international NGOs, even though there is coordination going on with the UN, and you're coming in and you're delivering the emergency immediate aid, be it shelters and tents or food and water or acute medical care that's needed when you're first triaging after a disaster, you realize there's a lot more that needs to be done. You can't just parachute in and then leave after those initial days, weeks. Because as we can see in Puerto Rico and other places, months later, there is still a lot of need. So we moved from just relief into development as well. And a lot of organizations often have the name relief and development. We never changed our name, but we do the role of both. And to us, again, I think like everyone here, there isn't really a definition of what that development is, but to us it means bringing dignity back to the people who have been affected by those disasters. And helping them rebuild their lives and seeing what their needs are in order for them to do that in a dignified manner. So as an organization, like most of the NGOs, we work irrespective of gender, race, religion, disability, all of the isms. We're really there to serve those who are in need and the beneficiaries. More and more these days, just because of the political situations that we're all aware of across the globe, we're also doing a lot of refugee work as well. And we're working in some of the most difficult climates, in some of the most difficult places with very protracted crises. So now we've kind of moved from the sphere of natural disasters into political conflicts and political disasters that are man-made, often in many cases. And so, you know, we often do get a lot of young people. We work in about 60 countries around the world, and we do get a lot of young people that want to volunteer, that are moved by what they see in the media, whose hearts are moved. And they want to know how they can, as students or young professionals, how they can get involved, how they can give back. It's very difficult in this climate to do volunteerism type work because of the situations. They're very unstable. They're often not safe. We've had our own staff on the ground in many cases, giving their lives for the mission of the work they do. However, I was just reading something kind of in preparation for this, that many university admissions office do look at these kind of volunteer opportunities and these international experiences as kind of extra points to get into college. And so we understand, you know, beyond like the internal motivation that a lot of people have that moves them to do this, there are also considerations around getting into college or getting into their professional career that drives them to want to do something in this space. However, in most instances, even if those intentions are benevolent, it often does more harm than good. And I'll give an example specifically just for Puerto Rico because it's close to us, it's recent. There were so many already you saw the devastation and the destruction and the homes, and there was no electricity, and there are already those aid agencies that are going in that are asked to come in. So that's one primary thing I need to mention, is that we're asked to come in. We don't go unless we're asked. And so already there's difficulty for housing, food and water for the local populations. And then if you're trying to add in a lot of people coming in as volunteers that are untrained, that are unskilled, who might unnecessarily get in the way, that's one thing. We do try and bring people to places where that may not be the case. For example, with all of the refugees coming into Europe, there were some opportunities where we were able to bring students and young professionals to Greece to help with the initial flows of the boats that were arriving on the shores, to help the families and the children get off the boats, to get dry, to get rid of those life jackets, to get them some food, some blankets, get them onto a bus to go somewhere they could shelter. However, again, we're often looking for people that speak those languages, because if you're receiving those people who are coming, who are traumatized, they need to see not just a warm smile and a warm face, but also someone that can understand them. And what's been most interesting for us as we're doing some of these volunteer activities is actually those people that are volunteering and that are fitting those criteria to help us on some of these trips were once themselves refugees or immigrants. That's why they have the language skills, but that's also why they want to give back. So I think I'm going to leave it at that for now, but take questions about our general work.
Well, thanks very much. I think it was, as I expected, people came from very different perspectives, but I think they all sort of come together around some common ideas and themes. Okay, so now I think we'll go to the QEA, so you can ask questions either through the app. So if you have the CWA app, I think probably all of you have been to at least one previous session, so you're familiar with that. You can also ask a question through a note card. So if you'd like to get a note card, please raise your hand, and someone will come around and give you a note card. Please write legibly, and if you are a student, please note this in your question, and make your questions brief and to the point. So I think I will take the liberty of asking the first question. And I can see in this audience, I think there are a number of students, and this goes a little bit to what Christina was suggesting. So I think there's probably a number of students here who have the question, I'd like to get involved in international development or in humanitarian relief efforts. What would you suggest I do? See if any of you would like to address that question.
I can start off. There's a lot of needs and a lot of opportunities right here in the United States. And so I would say don't forget that. As an organization like ours who has a portfolio that's both international and domestic, when there are not opportunities available to go abroad for the reasons I mentioned, safety, security concerns, et cetera, there's so much need and so many projects that a lot of groups are doing here. We took many students to volunteer to distribute water when the Flint, Michigan water crisis happened. We have taken many students to areas affected here in the U.S. by natural disasters and hurricanes. While there are things like Houston that just happened and everyone wants to jump on, and again, this comes back to the issue of not having enough hotels and places to situate people, there are still conflicts from hurricanes in the past, like Hurricane Matthew in North Carolina, where people are still rebuilding their communities, where homes are still being rebuilt. And we work with a lot of churches and synagogues and mosques, and we bring student groups together to actually go. And you don't have to be an engineer. All you have to know how to do is hit a nail with a hammer. And we do bring groups to do a lot of domestic projects.
Maybe I could add a couple of things to that. I like very much what Christina has said about the opportunities both domestically as well as internationally. A few more words about the international opportunities. There are large numbers of NGOs. Remember, however, that those NGOs are not likely to have the money to be able to pay for you to go overseas. If you really want to be a volunteer in it, and you may have to pay your own way, that's something, however, you can do as a younger person. As you grow and develop in your career professionally and in skills, then you can think about working in development in larger organizations, whether that is as a volunteer or as a staff member. But if you want to work in institutions like major consulting firms or the World Bank or USAID, you cannot expect to get a job there as a volunteer right out of college. They are going to look for a high level of technical expertise and probably many years of experience before you would be you would be brought in. Most of the people who work in the World Bank on development actually come to the World Bank as a second career, often over the age of 40. You need to calibrate your expectations about realistic opportunities that are out there in the environment. They do exist, and I encourage you to draw upon them. Thanks.
I think if you really want to be a volunteer, one of the things you should think about is, are you lovely naturally? Do you know how to love other people? Do you know how to cope with other people? Or are you going to bring your experience from America and bring it to East Africa, for example? And you want people to treat you the same way you are treated here. We need people who really are understanding and people who are very lovely, because we have some good examples of just few students who represented America in a very crazy way. Are you coming to Africa to dance and to just be in the hostel with bunch of volunteers having fun and just use 1 hour with the community? Yeah, just make sure before you start to go and volunteer to one of these countries, find out people around you. Like in University of Colorado, you have study abroad, Tanzania, which Laura Di Luca is in there, Nicole and other people. They've been to Africa. Talk to them. Ask them. If you cannot go yourself, ask people who have been away from America how life is about on the other side. It is 100% different lifestyles. Know that before you get in the plane to volunteer.
It's really about an attitude of modesty and humility and willingness to learn.
Okay. I find managing the questions is more challenging than being a speaker, I've discovered. So I think Maggie actually just, there were several questions for Maggie that were about what she just spoke on, this question of how about volunteer tourism? Is that something that's a good thing or not? And I think Maggie pretty much answered that question, that I think she would say yes if you come with the right attitude and approach, which I think is a great insight. So there are a few questions which are on the kind of bigger theory, bigger questions of development. Is continued poverty in developing nations most easily explained by institutions, interactions, or geography? And why is it, what is the role of the legacy of colonialization? So I think I'll put that forward as what are the big causes of development or lack thereof?
I'll give a try at that, but I'd also like to push that question back to our moderator, and we'll probably have somewhat different answers. I don't think there is a single simple answer to the question. There are, what are the multiple, the barriers are multiple. I see them largely, but certainly far from exclusively, as institutional and political. And within that, you may have colonialism, you may have domestic attitudes, you may have international attitudes. So I don't give a single simple answer. Thank you. You're not going to answer that?
I regret asking the question. Yeah, so there's this is the subject of many degrees and dissertations and books. I mean, I think the dominant view now in the field is essentially one of institutions. There's a book called Why Nations Fail, which I think represents the sort of the dominant thinking at this point in time, which may change, which is generally tells the story that you have many developing countries that were previously colonies, and when they were colonies, the set of institutions that those countries have was established by the colonial powers. And then there's variation across countries in what those institutions look like. And institutions is, of course, a very broad term that can refer to the set of laws the country has, the set of norms the country has, the way the government interacts with society as a whole. And it's a bit of a nebulous term. But the general story that book and that thinking puts forward is that those institutions were established during the colonial period of many of these countries. And in many cases, those institutions were not designed to serve the mass of people. So in particular, you have many countries where the institutions were set up basically for the colonial powers to extract from those colonies. And so the institutions those countries then had were extractive institutions, not institutions that supported the development in those countries. And so then those institutions have been persistent over time, and now you still have many countries where there's a fairly narrow elite that benefits from those institutions, but not the mass of people. So unfortunately, we have good ideas about how to do lots of things. We know how to reduce infant mortality. We know a bit about how to improve education systems. We don't have a good sense, really, of how to change institutions. So that's certainly a challenge for those of us working in development. And I think my general view of the kind of work I do is that I see it as important, but somewhat more marginal, or somewhat more at the... I don't see my role as one of being able to transform societies, which maybe when I was a younger student, I may have been a bit more naive in what I could accomplish as a World Bank economist. And I think I see my role and the role of people working with similar organizations as one of trying to help out country governments to address problems where there's a need and a willingness on the part of the government.
So. Just one thing, if I could add to that. It's notable that both in my reaction and in Gabriel's reactions, there was no mention of money. And yet both of us have worked in an institution which has had as its principal instrument and comparative advantage large amounts of money.
And I also want to take it back from the institutional level back to the communities and the individuals, just as a practitioner. The inequalities that we were talking about earlier, and I think when someone asked this question, this might be what they're getting at as well, but those that are the most marginalized within these communities and within these countries are generally the most vulnerable when there are natural disasters or conflicts already, because they're living in floodplain zones, they live in shoddy constructed houses, so if there's an earthquake, those are the ones that collapse. If there's a flood, you know, those are the ones whose houses are going to be flooded. So there's already that dynamic of those inequalities within those societies as well that makes them most vulnerable already. So they're doubly vulnerable.
So question for Maggie. We use the term poverty a lot in development. Do you use that term? And if so, how? And does the development community think of it the same way that people in Tanzania do?
Can you ask me again?
So the term poverty, mm-hmm. How is that a term that you use, and if so, how?
We normally sit around campfire at night when the moon is shining and stars, and then we ask ourselves, what does it mean when we say poverty? And also, it has a big picture, because we can see some people in our countries who are stakeholders, who are very wealthy. Some of them have like 72 cars, 5 houses, a lot of materials, but we don't see them, they're happy. So we normally say those people are also poor. So it's also poverty. They're not happy, actually. So there's a lot of meaning of that, and we don't have one answer when we talk about If you are greed, you are poor. We believe in four pillars of life. We believe in gratitude. We believe in love. We believe in abundance and then compassion. It doesn't matter how much you have. We normally look down and say, I can help. I can do something. I can give back to the world. And so we normally use a good example of your president. I'm sorry. I'm not a politician. But we don't have a lot of technology, but at least we have WhatsApp. And when we open it, many people, they post houses of the Trump and many things that he possesses. And we look at his face. He looks very sad. So it's, I don't know if he's rich, he's wealth or poor. Is that poverty or I don't know. So thank you.
So regarding reducing poverty within countries, how do you align the efforts of nonprofits with local governments, especially if they're known to be corrupt and limit outside groups? How do you achieve progress on a larger scale?
How do you achieve progress on a larger scale, particularly if you're working with nonprofits in environments where there's a high level of corruption?
Yeah.
The first and simple answer to that is it's incredibly difficult to do. The second answer is a little more subtle. In practically every country and environment, there are possibilities for horizontal cooperation across people and across institutions. It is possible to find allies both within the civil society as well as within the public sector, even in the case of countries that are characterized by high levels of corruption. Sure, it's going to be hard. No one's expecting it's going to be easy. But what I'm trying to suggest is that this is not a simple yes or no answer. It's a question of the degree of challenge. One of the things I have been doing in recent years since I left the World Bank is work with an NGO called the Partnership for Transparency. And this body works with developing and emerging country NGOs to help them to engage in dialogue with their own local and national authorities about issues of corruption. The best environments certainly are environments where governments are open to dialogue with the civil society, where the legislation affecting NGOs is sound. And unfortunately, in recent years, in a number of countries, that legislation has become much more restrictive. The answer is to try. Thank you.
An organization like ours, we definitely have a mission and a strategy to work with the most vulnerable. So how do we identify those groups? We work with the local NGOs. We work with the faith community a lot. I think that's the way we kind of bypass working sometimes. We're invited by the governments. The governments know we're there. But by working directly with the communities and through the churches and faith leaders and the Muslim community at large, a lot of our programming, again, depending on where the context is and where it is interfaith. But I think that's how we build the trust. And when you build the trust with the local communities, then that kind of percolates out, and then the local governments see the results and are more trusting as well of the projects on the ground.
All countries could not possibly have the level of consumption as the U.S. What's the way forward for these less developed countries? Should the U.S. Seek to change their system, and how so? And I might combine that with what I see as a related question. International development actors seem to be not addressing the issue of climate change, yet climate change will be the biggest negative influence on development of societies in the future. What do you think about that?
I'll try. Levels of consumption in the U.S. and around the world. I agree that this is a huge challenge. And interestingly enough, one of the Agenda 2030 goals has to do with developing levels of consumption around the world, which are indeed sustainable. And this implies that it would indeed be desirable to change the nature of much consumption within this country as well as others in the industrial world. We can't all address all issues, and I think I may leave much of that to our friends in Boulder. But on climate change, I disagree with the implicit assumption of the question, namely that the international community is not addressing climate change. In fact, there's a lot going on climate change internationally, with the U.S. lagging significantly behind. Certainly many of you are familiar with the Paris Agreement on climate change, which the U.S. is in the process of disengaging itself from. Interestingly enough, however, enterprises within this country, local and state governments within this country, are paying increasing attention to climate change, regardless of what the federal government is doing. And we see increasingly, at least as I appreciate the situation, that other governments are determined to move forward internationally on climate change, even if the U.S. is not, for now, participating at the federal government level internationally. U.S. NGOs and philanthropists are, however, very deeply engaged internationally. Thanks.
Yeah, I want to jump in on that one as well, because this is an actual example of what I was just talking about, where communities are coming together to work together. So I think a lot of the church groups were, you know, very inspired and mobilized after the Pope came out with the encyclical on climate change, and it actually mobilized our organization across our 60 countries to come together and make a similar statement. It was the Islamic Declaration on climate change. We actually held several regional consultations around the globe because we didn't want it to be an organizational statement, but rather a faith statement, similar as the Pope's statement was. And we brought together other faith organizations from within our faith tradition to come together on the wordsmithing and the words. So we've used those documents together as communities to do a lot of advocacy, both, again, at the local level within many countries. We're also trying to use that here in the United States. That's a much more difficult task.
Gabriel, maybe I can put the question back to you to say a little bit about your understanding of what's going on in the World Bank and other multilateral development banks on climate change.
Yeah, so that's a big focus for what the World Bank does these days. And a lot of that has to do with, so there's both the question of helping countries to avoid contributing to climate change, and then also working to help countries adapt to the climate change that is coming. On the first part, I mean, a lot of that is helping to trying to help countries move away from fossil fuel-based energy sources and more towards renewables. And I don't work on that personally, but in general, I'd say that's one of the top priorities, the top focus areas of the World Bank these days.
Let me add something a little bit according to my level. I went to Portland, Oregon, and somebody took me to a big mall, and I thought I was dreaming. Sometimes we think people in America are doing the best things, which I'm going back home and I'll tell them about. It is wrong. It's not true. We saw a lot of plastics. People are coming with their families, and they're buying lots of things in plastics. I don't know where they bring all these plastics every day, but they're so good people to talk about, advocates about climate change, environmental issues, but they don't start from themselves, from individual, from your family. Think about that first before you talk about advocates, whatever, and issues, I think. So I've seen a lot of things that are going on here, and it's real. It makes us cry. Yeah.
At the local level, we can have taxes on things like small plastic bags.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they are being increasingly adopted. I don't know what it's like in Boulder, but I know other cities that applies.
So I want to go back to, this is a question which goes straight to something that Maggie had said, and it'd be good to, maybe if she has further thoughts on this, but also from the other panelists. But what are your thoughts on the loss of culture that can happen with development?
I see a lot of, again, we have national parks. And those national parks, most of them, they were people's land. And because we need development, we made magazine to be a national park so that we can have money, which is good. But people who are living outside of the national parks in our country are part of that ecosystem. And so, of course, they need a certain percent from what is coming in the national park. But what I see people are doing as a development is they build big lodges on the trails of the elephants. So when the elephant comes, you know how they put memory, they keep memories. A matriarch leads the way and she goes and like, oh, it's blocked. So they turn back. They take another way, oh, permanent campsite. So, what I will suggest you to do, people who have privileges, you travel with your family to Africa. When you come, choose those companies that links with people, with communities, that you can sit down and interact with them. And you know, by doing that, a certain percent will go directly to this community, village bank, etc. And these people do their projects according to what they have. And then there will be source of those people who will have voice because they'll have money to talk about. We don't like to see you coming here and build the lodges. This is our land. We're not ready for that. I am not the only one who are doing that within my tour company. You can take my business card after this. There's a lot also other people, few companies in this world, who are doing a friendly ecotourism safaris. You come with your cameras, three of you in a big safari truck. You enjoy to look, see elephants, oh, look at little babies, wow. You want to see lion kill, zebra are eating, beautiful birds, hiking safaris. All those are good because you're enjoying with your family. And because also you didn't know the other side of the stories, choose the best companies that interact with indigenous people. Then we make change together. Thank you.
I wanted to flip that around. We had a panel earlier this week. I don't know if anyone was at that was about small farming. I think the mission, and I hope, you know, the goal most of the time for organizations such as ours is actually to preserve culture rather than to destroy it. And the reason I was mentioning the small farming, especially in those who might have been at that panel, if you look at the traditional ways that people have livelihoods, and as we talk about climate change, and as we talk about urbanization, as we talk about conflict, and people's traditional modes of how they've been employed and how they've lived, are being disrupted and they're moving into urban centers. Through organizations that are trying to do international development, we're also trying to help maintain you know, by supporting local farmers, by especially a lot of them are women farmers, giving them access to seeds and new technologies and fertilizers and new training techniques and access to markets so that they can sell their goods. We're actually trying to help them preserve culture as opposed to disrupting it. That's the goal.
Let me just underscore what Christine had said about preserving culture, particularly traditional cultures, as an important dimension of development. Remember also that cultures are not stable. They are changing and evolving all the time. And I think sometimes people may have too romantic a notion of development as preserving traditional culture without change, without external involvement. Remember also that development has brought billions of people out of poverty. It has increased the opportunities for billions of people. If we had just insisted on maintaining their cultures and situations as they were before, that would not have happened. Thank you.
So make sure if you engage yourself in it, know those people, know what they need and who they are. Because we know who we are and what we need and what we want to change. Like, I don't like to see anybody circumcise my daughter. Those kind of things I can change. Yeah. I don't like to see them. Because I know the negative impact about it. And there's more things to change, but not somebody to come and say, oh, you guys are doing this kind of lifestyle. No, you should develop. You should have supermarkets. You should have these. You have to. We live the best life also, but we need a little bit of support to make our life better. Water, schools, healthcare, etc.
So there were a few questions about the role of the U.S. So is the U.S. a positive force in international development? What should be the role of the U.S.? Does the U.S. have particular responsibility, especially with regard to climate change? So pick and choose your areas you want to respond to in those questions.
I'll start. Of course I'm convinced, I wouldn't have spent my life on it, that the U.S. has important international development responsibilities. But I don't think the U.S. is unique in that. I think this applies to all countries and all peoples around the world. One of the things that may be behind the question is a responsibility for the present situation, the allegations that the U.S. is responsible for a damage to the climate, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes we can have a political debate about that kind of thing. I think personally most of those debates are not particularly fruitful. That we can work together with people to identify together things that can lead to improvement. The U.S. plays an important role, whether we like it or not, in international trade, in international finance, in international education, and we should work, all of us, at the margins and within our own communities to help those activities contribute more positively to improvements in the lives and conditions of people around the world. Thank you.
Again, I don't want to make this politicized, but I do, you know, there is a role that the U.S. needs and should be playing. I'll just speak more specifically to the refugee crisis. I'm just curious if anyone knows, if we look at a country like Syria, we know what's happening. We've been following this for the past 7 years. We've been probably following what's happened in the last couple of days. Does anyone know how many Syrian refugees have been let into the U.S. through the refugee resettlement as of right now for 2018? Guess? Let's make. I'm just talking about Syrians. So this year, We've dropped the numbers of refugee resettlements that were under the previous administration under Obama. We had a number of 90,000. Last year got dropped to 55,000. This year it got dropped to 45,000, which we probably won't meet at the rate and the how slowly they're coming in through the vetting system. But I was speaking to Syrians specifically. As of today, we've had 11 Syrians who have entered the United States. So when we look at things like that, and as we're talking about, you know, what kind of role the U.S. has to play, I think that's a dismal record on us. And so I think that we need to step up our game.
I think another role that Americans should play is we see a lot of Americans, people who come to Africa and they have good hearts, want to help. Some of them, they don't come, but they will keep, like, connect with people in there, either the government or an NGO or individuals. But the way Americans are doing it, to me, it's like they destroy, they cause more poverty because they think only dumping money is a solution. Think about how Africa is. It's good to know it a little bit, at least quarter way. Ask other people, learn about us. Know us first before dumping money, because a big percent of money will end up to the few families, stakeholders. It's not a bad thing. Maybe they, because you're dealing with those kind of vulnerable families and you're dumping money to the government, what do you think that money will do? You say, oh, this is for education for girls. Oh, this is for women groups. This is for what? But you don't connect yourself. You're doing like when the bird is pooping. It's pooping and flying. You're not connecting yourself. So make sure you teach your kids, your students, and et cetera, on how to volunteer in Africa. What helps and what hurts. Not only in Africa, Asia, or in all these countries, other colleagues are mentioning. Because Americans are very potential and they are privileged, and there are many, you know. But for those few who have been done a lot, they've done a little bit nothing, sorry, because of that attitude.
Remember what Maggie said at the beginning. Good intentions are not enough.
So combining a few different questions and comments here. So first, someone asked me to point out that for local ways to volunteer, there is a volunteer resource center on campus. So I was asked to highlight that. But then there were a couple questions. One on the volunteering. So if somebody wants to find a way to volunteer opportunities that are in touch with and respect local sensitivities, where would they look? I think for Tanzania, they would come and talk to Maggie. But beyond that, do we have suggestions for how to find other opportunities beyond Tanzania? And then I think a related question is, how can we make sure money we donate to organizations is going to organizations that provide and work on development instead of negatively affecting people? So if you want to volunteer or donate, where would you go to get more information?
You want to try, and then I'll add to?
So all of the international NGOs that are U.S.-based, and there's about 200 that are officially registered and that fall under the purview of an organization in Washington, D.C. called Interaction. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of the umbrella organization that checks standards and best practices for all of us operating overseas. So not only do we have to self-certify every year, show what we're doing, but there are a lot of outside, external, third-party Better Business Bureau, charity types of navigator websites you can go to. All of the international charities are required by law to publicly and transparently put their 990s every year, so you can get information that's very transparent. So you definitely want to, you know, if you're donating money, check all of those online sources because they are rated. And we've actually moved, the industry has moved a bit as well, so you're not just rated by things like best overhead rate so that most of the money is getting to the actual beneficiaries. But they've actually started adding some new categories, such as impact on the ground and outcomes of the work that's for the money and how it's being used, which I think is actually a good indicator that's recently been added in the past couple of years. So I know it's Charity Navigator. Is one of the main sites, but there's a couple of others. That's the one off the top of my head.
Let me add a few words to Christina's. The organization InterAction is a terrific organization, and I strongly encourage you to look at the InterAction website and learn from it. However, the InterAction has a dues level which makes it hard for relatively small NGOs to become members. So I wouldn't limit my interest to the activities of InterAction. You can learn an enormous amount on the internet just by Googling and looking with particular interest in particular issues. The IRS Forms 990 are incredibly informative. And if you can't find that kind of information, then I would say be a little cautious. There are also financial intermediaries, increasingly, that are engaged in international development. One in particular I would underscore for you, which I have been impressed by, is called Global Giving. If you go to the Global Giving website, you can contribute directly to Global Giving, which in turn will allocate the funds. And Global Giving also sponsors projects in the hundreds from different NGOs around the world. And those projects are carefully vetted by Global Giving, and Global Giving in turn has an important responsibility. So you have a certain guarantee in working with institutions like Global Giving. Thanks.
And I would just add to that, there are a lot of companies, and also if you work for the federal government, for example, where these organizations have all been vetted and there are matching opportunities. So you can donate and your corporate employer and or the government will also match. So again, that's another way to kind of vet if an organization such as ours and a lot of the big ones appear on these lists, then they've been fully vetted.
Can you talk about also small organization? Please. Can you talk about it?
Small organizations are frequently a challenge. And yet, at some level, they're the ones that are most needy. Yeah. And one way to work with small organizations is through intermediaries, which in turn can work with them. Global Giving works with many small organizations, but that's not an exclusive answer. Another way to work with small organizations is through religious groups. Many of them have important linkages. I wish there were a simple, single answer. Maybe, Gabriel, you know from your work in Philippines, Vietnam, and other countries about ways that individuals can engage.
Yeah, I think it's hard to evaluate small organizations unless you see them up front. Now, I've, you know, living in different... also know Maggie, but you know, it's been an advantage that living in different countries that's allowed me to get to know individual organizations in those countries, which my wife and I donate to. But I think that it's quite a challenge to do that from afar. I think there are a lot of good answers to this question. And another one I wanted to give is there's an organization called GiveWell, which does evaluations, you know, taking into account very strong evaluations done of different efforts and looking at what organizations do. And so I find their recommendations quite compelling. So my, you know, in thinking about where to donate myself, I take a sort of combination of local organizations that I know, what I see from GiveWell and their analysis of what are effective organizations. And then I also look at the Charity Navigator and similar sites to see, just in terms of the basics, what the organization does. And I look at, you can find out what percentage of the organization's expenditures go to fundraising.
Yeah.
So if the organization is spending half of its money raising more money, I feel like that's not an organization that I want to give to. And also I look at how much the CEO of the organization is paid. Now, you know, there's a strong case for paying the head of an organization well, so you get somebody who's effective. But if their salary is, you know, in the several hundred thousand dollars, I think that's not appropriate for a charity organization.
The service clubs are terrific. Yeah. Rotary International, Lions Club, others.
Yeah. Yeah.
Certainly, there are lots of opportunities.
So here's a slightly different question. It's about the TOMS model. So TOMS is this company which I believe sells shoes and then donates shoes. I think if you buy a pair of shoes, they also make a donation. I know there's been some controversy about that. The question also asks about Warby Parker. I'm actually not familiar with that, but maybe some of you are. But I think the TOMS question is probably one that you're, at least some of you are familiar with. So if you have any comments on that.
Do you want to start? Christine? All right. I think the TOMS model is a good one. How widely it's applicable, I don't know. But the important thing about it from my standpoint is that it represents a way for the business community and businesses to engage in international development. And I think the question of how local businesses do this and one way or another is important to raise. It is not just a matter of corporate social responsibility. I think we need to get beyond that. What is your contribution in your firm to a better world?
So we use this as a case study recently for a training we had for our own staff and looked at the pros and cons of models like TOMS. To be specific to TOMS, there's some very positive things, such as they're not just giving shoes to children on a one-time basis. The local organizations that they work with have to have a commitment that the shoes are going to be, because children's feet grow. So the children need to be given a new pair of shoes every 6 months, every year, whatever it is. So it's this model to kind of sustaining within the same community rather than a one-off, they got a pair of shoes and they outgrew them, they got holes in them, whatever. They also work with local community groups to make sure it's not just about shoes, but it's connected with other kind of sectoral projects. So in places where there's guinea worm or, you know, diseases that children can pick up through the soil if they're walking barefoot, they make sure there's an education component so children also understand why they should be wearing shoes. So I think those types of pieces are very positive, in the sense that sometimes groups like this might be displacing local business. They're, you know, bringing in a ton of shoes in a community where maybe there was an industry that the local community had shoes, built shoes, and now you're displacing that livelihood. That's where it can become a con as opposed to a pro. So you have to look at it holistically.
There's also a general question on the proliferation of digital communication technologies such as smartphones and possibilities that creates for data collection and dissemination. So the question was specifically asked about how that affects local development organizations, but I think we could also ask that more broadly, how does that affect development and opportunities for development?
Simple answer is very profoundly. It can be positive. We've heard many times about the incredible importance that mobile phone banking has had in Africa. It's a wonderful example. If nothing else, we've learned in recent days with Facebook and the testimony of Mark Zuckerberg on Capitol Hill that digital technology and Facebook in particular have their downsides, and in my view, we're going to face a torrent of regulation, which will be important affecting this area, and particularly digital technology in international development. Thank you.
Defer this one to Maggie.
I think technology in development is good. I've seen good examples in our community where I am from, but a big challenge is how to charge it. And so at some point when people are talking about mobile and these kind of things, they should also think about solar panel for charging things. So people dump a lot of mobile and technology in our country. Maybe it's good, but it's also good to think about things like solar panel or, yeah, if technology has to be beyond America and other developed countries.
Gabriel, offer your own reactions on this one before you open another question.
Oh. Yeah, you put me on the spot. I mean, generally, there's a lot of potential. I guess I've kind of swung back and forth between a feeling that maybe there was too much hype around the potential for digital technology to make great transformations. But I've swung between that and work that I've done as part of the hype, showing that the possibilities there. I mean, it's no question. It's not, in another panel, I gave the example in Kenya that there's this M-Pesa system that allows people to transfer money with their mobile phones, and essentially everyone now in Kenya uses this system. So there's no question that's been a major improvement in welfare for people in Kenya, but there's also a question of to what extent that really is a major driver of development. I think I still see that as a question. I mean, I can see lots of positive impacts of technology on the people's welfare and also the work of NGOs. I have a friend of mine, a friend of a friend in who works actually in Tanzania and has developed this children's program, sort of a Sesame Street type program, mm-hmm. using which is cheap to produce using digital technology. And I think she and her organization wouldn't have been able to do that 10, 20 years ago before the advance of that technology. So I see that definitely as a huge positive. But yeah, maybe I still would be somewhat skeptical of saying that technology itself is going to be a transformative phenomenon for developing countries.
Yeah, I was just thinking of one example. When I was recently in like the Jordan and Lebanon region, the UN is trying to use some technology for cash that they're giving out to Syrian refugees, whereas the cash used to, you know, once they're registered and they've registered how many people are in the family and what the needs are and they've figured out the allotment, they used to give that out in the form of like cards and other payments, and now they're using these more sophisticated, they're testing these more sophisticated systems that are more like ATMs that have even iris eye scanners where the people can go up. Now, they're thinking that it's going to be more efficient, it's going to eliminate some fraud because people won't get money twice maybe because it's recognizing their eyes. But at the same time, it's eliminating that human-to-human part of what was, you know, initially giving out that also was not just a cash transaction, but it had a human component to it, as well as the fact that now there are many people that are unemployed that used to actually have that role within the community that were actually going and serving those refugees. So I think it's the jury's still out whether it's better or worse.
Yeah. One other technology which is emerging, I think will be increasingly important, is biometric identification, which is a very important initiative of the government of India to have biometric identification of the entire Indian population. And this will facilitate the provision of public services in India and should give rise to a significant reduction in corruption, which has been very widespread in the access by the Indian population to basic services of education and health and the right to a minimal level of food. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to go back to the mobile and share with you on how impact it is in our community. Most of the families where I am from, women are supposed to stay home. You are not supposed to go out. You just do a lot of these activities at home, grazing the cows, fetching water like from home to very far away, like 2-3 hours, collecting firewood, etc. Lots of hard activities. And since you are not allowed to like go and meet other women groups, then mobile phone have been helping us to connect. Mm-hmm. And it helps, it makes sense, huge impact. As long as there's power.
Yeah, with a few more seconds to reflect, I thought of some other examples, positive and not so positive. I think, on the mobile phone, the M-Pesa work, similar systems in Tanzania, and one thing that we found in the work that we did in Kenya was that for women especially, the M-Pesa system was extremely important because there were these women who were working as small-scale entrepreneurs, and they would bring home cash, and in many cases, their husbands would insist that they give them the money. And so by having the money in their phone, sort of concealed, that was a way for them to maintain power over their own resources. So that's certainly a positive story. I mean, I think a case where there's been a bit of hype on technology, I spoke about this in the education panel I was on a couple days ago, maybe 10 years ago, there was a lot of hope that you could just give children a laptop and that would be all that they needed to access the internet and get all the education that they needed. And there have been a number of studies which I think have clearly demonstrated that's not the case, that just giving people technology without any contextualization, without a support system, that doesn't work. And I think anybody who's worked on education in developing countries has had the experience of going to a school and seeing a bunch of computers that no one's using. So there's really a clear recognition that technology can be a positive force in education, but it has to be thoughtful, it has to be combined with a whole system and not just sort of airdropped or parachuted into a school. The national ID work that Ed mentioned, so that's actually a principal focus of the World Bank now. So the India model is seen as this great success, and actually right now in the Philippines, we're working with the government to advance that. The Congress in the Philippines has just passed a law to create a new national ID. We've been a big part of the support, the technical support on making that happen for precisely the reasons that Ed described, that will allow, we expect that will allow much easier access, especially for the poor, to government services, because without an ID, it's very hard for people to access many of those government services.
Before we close this one, I'd want to move a little bit beyond information technology, which is what has been the whole focus. There are all sorts of other technologies which are existing and in development, which could have a transformative impact on development. Just to mention, gene splicing is one. There's an article by Bill Gates in the current issue of Foreign Affairs on applications of gene splicing, which are being supported by the Gates Foundation. Think also about agricultural research. If we don't have a lot of continuing and new agricultural research increasing production capacities, we will not be able to feed the growing population of the world. So it's important for those who are committed to the cause of development that we support the development and application of new technologies with all the cautions and reservations we must have about them.
Okay, so I think that we'll stop it there and wrap it up. This was a